Rabbi Yona Ries comes to us. It's been here before, but we shouldn't take it for granted. He has an exceptionally busy job. He's in charge of Yeshiva University's learning programs, if you will. He's the dean of the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, one of the most important yeshivas in the world. It's not an exaggeration, even if I'm biased because I went there. But Rabbi Ries has an enormous amount of responsibility and is a guiding force to make sure that the yeshiva is not only flourishing on a local level, but is assuring strong communal growth on an international level. Rabbi Ries previously served; he was in charge of the Beis Din of America. And in a previous life, was a lawyer, Cleary Gottlieb, if I'm not mistaken, and therefore comes to us this morning with really a wealth of experience with regards to the very sensitive but yet extremely important issue pertaining to halachic approaches to agunot. And it's an honor for us to have him. And I, on a personal level, have had the privilege of knowing Rabbi Ries for a long time, remembering him from Beis Medrash days, and it's wonderful to have him here with us, and it's a pleasure to call upon him to share with us some important insights about this very timely topic.
Thank you very much, and good morning. I am honored to be here in the presence of Rabbi Schmidman, Rabbi Seif, Rabbi Eis, other distinguished Rabbanim and colleagues and friends and Talmidim from the yeshiva. It's always a special schus to be able to come up to Philadelphia to speak before you. I decided this time to choose an easy topic. The subject of agunot. It's really not an easy topic at all. I'd like to just start with a quotation from the Tshuvos HaBach. The Bach, of course, was an eminent rabbinic authority who lived in the 16th to 17th century in Krakow. And there's a collection of responsa. In the responsa of the Bach, as in the responsa of many great rabbinic authorities, not everything that's found in the collection was necessarily authored by the namesake of the Sefer. So there's a famous comment that's made about Agunot that's found in the Tshuvos HaBach. It wasn't actually authored by the Bach himself, but nonetheless, since it merited inclusion within his Tshuvot, it is certainly worthy of mention as a part and parcel of what constitutes the Tshuvos HaBach. And that is that in the Tshuvos is a quotation from the Pasuk from Koheles, the Perek Dalet of Koheles, where, and that's obviously also an appropriate source to bring for this community, where Melech Shlomo says, V'shapti ani, I went and returned v'ereh, es kol ha'ashukim asher na'asim tachas ha'shamesh. I looked at all of the people who were oppressed underneath the sun. V'hinei dimas ha'ashukim, and I saw the tears of the oppressed, v'ein lohem menachem, and there's nobody to comfort them. U'miyad ha'shkehem koach, and they're buckling under all of the strength and the power of those who are oppressing them. Ve'ein lohem menachem, there's nobody to console them. And this source says that this is an allusion when Koheles refers to the Dimasa Ashukim, to the tears of the oppressed. It's an allusion to Agunot. It's an allusion to women who are chained. They're chained in their marriage because their husbands are either missing and therefore the marriage is functionally over, but the husbands aren't around to give them a get. Or, as we know in the modern day context, the more familiar case of Aguna is a husband who is not missing. He's very much in front of us and very visible, but he's refusing to give his wife a get, and therefore, even though their marriage is functionally over, the woman is trapped because the marriage she's in is over and she hasn't been freed to enter into a new marriage because her husband refuses to give her a bill of divorce, refuses to give her a get. In fact, there was somebody who wrote a book. It was a popular book that was published several years ago about the plight of the Aguna, And he picked up from this medrash, and he titled his book, The Tears of the Oppressed, based upon this medrash. The Tshuva Sabach goes on to say that if somebody does resolve an aguna case and does enable a woman who is shackled in a marriage that is functionally over and unable to proceed with her life, and then somebody comes along and frees this aguna and enables her to be freed and to be able to remarry, then it's as if they have built one of the Chobos Yerushalayim. It's as if they have built from the ruins of Yerushalayim. In fact, the Maharsha, one of famous rabbinic commentary on the Gemara, at the end of Maseches Yevamos, says that anybody who resolves an aguna situation and enables an aguna to be free to remarry is considered to be building the Beis HaMikdash. Laman Beis Hashem Elokeinu. He says it's an allusion to somebody who's able to free an aguna. The explanation that he gives as to why it's akin to building the Beis HaMikdash is because when a woman marries, then she's able to have more children. And the Gemara says that Ein Ben David Ba, that the Mashiach won't come Ad Shichlu Kol Neshama Shebeguf, until all of the souls that are meant to be born in this universe are going to be born. So that's his explanation. Another possible explanation is based on the Gemara in Barachos that says that whenever anybody is Mesameach Achasin Vekala, anybody dances and rejoices at a wedding, so it's as if they built Achas Michovos Yerushalayim, that they have built from the ruins of Yerushalayim. That appears to be a more direct source for this statement, which is found in the Tshuva Sabach. So we know that it is a very compelling thing. It's a very important objective for every individual and for the community as a whole to resolve aguna situations, that this is considered to be a scourge, it's considered to be a blemish upon the community whenever there is an aguna, whenever there is a woman who is trapped in a functionless marriage and not able to remarry. And our rabbis always made special takanos. They always made special enactments, special laws that were intended to help women who would be in this type of situation. There is a general controversy about whether the rabbis are doing enough in order to be able to ameliorate aguna problems in the community. Is one famous aguna advocate who coined a phrase a number of years ago that if there's a rabbinic will, then there's a rabbinic way, that if there would only be more of a desire on the part of the rabbis to resolve all of the problems, then the rabbis would be able to find the way. And then there are those who take the position that we have basically whatever resources are at our disposal, and if there was anything more that could have been done, we would have done it already. You can't go search for new innovations because they're unlikely to be consistent with the halakha. I take a slightly different view. I just would turn around the phrase and say that if there's a rabbinic way, then there ought to be a rabbinic will. That if we're able to find solutions that are effective, al pi halacha, that are suitable and appropriate for our communities, for our situations, then it's our job, just like we see that the rabbis throughout all the generations made special takanos within the framework of halacha in order to help agunot, then we have to make sure to do everything that is in our power. And as long as there's even one aguna out there, as long as there's even one unresolved situation out there, it means that we're not doing enough. It means that we have to try to do enough. But we can't automatically come up with solutions that aren't going to be helpful because they don't have a basis in halakha. That's why it's very important to have a very careful halakhic analysis of the entire landscape of the issue and figure out what can be done and figure out what cannot be done. So there are a couple of examples. If you look at the source sheets, I prepared a source sheet that's a little bit long. It's about four pages, and I'm not planning to go through every single word of every single source. But I wanted to touch upon the sources and give them to you so you would be able to have them for easy reference. But there's a mistake that people sometimes make when they discuss the issue of agunot. They say, yeah, it's true that the rabbis were lenient when it came to agunot, but they were only dealing with a different type of aguna situation. In the Talmud, most of the discussion about agunot, especially if you look at the end of the Gemara in Maseches Yevamos, is about the man who's missing at sea. That you have a happily married couple, and then a man goes on a business trip, and the ship sinks, and we haven't been able to recover the ship or find any of the survivors, so we think that the man is probably dead, but we can't prove it for sure. And then there are various rules that relax the usual evidentiary requirements of testimony and say that even though normally we would require two kosher witnesses to testify that something happened, when it comes to testifying that a man has died so that the wife will be permitted to remarry, so we allow even one witness. That's source number two from the Gemara in Yevamos on Daf Pei Ches. And there's a whole discussion among the various Talmudic commentaries as to what's the justification, what's the basis for allowing for even one witness's testimony to be sufficient, and it doesn't have to be a witness who's normally considered to be a kosher witness. It could even be a relative. It could even be others who might not normally be a kosher witness. And there are explanations given that since the woman understands the severity of being married to a man when her first husband is still alive, which would be a violation of adultery, and if it turns out that the first husband walks through the door and he's really not dead, then she won't be permitted to either man anymore, and she will have been in an adulterous relationship, and any children who were born will be illegitimate, will be mamzerim, so she herself will be daiku mitzvah. She herself will be very careful to make sure that the testimony of the one witness is accurate, and therefore, that's the justification for the relaxation of the evidentiary rule. But aquaponim, and we see that there is a relaxation of the rule, and the Gemara says explicitly, Mishumi guna kilu barabanan, that because it's our job to prevent agunot, it's our job to do what is peaceful and pleasant in the service of the Almighty, to racheha dalche noam, and therefore, that is our primary motivation for finding a halakhic basis for relaxing the evidentiary rules. So some were of the opinion that this applies to the case only of the man who's missing at sea. That's when we find all kinds of leniencies, because we know that the fellow is probably dead, but we can't absolutely prove it. So therefore, we find ways to relax the normal evidentiary rules. But the Gemara wasn't really talking about what's the modern-day aguna situation, namely the man who is alive, but is refusing to give his wife a get, refusing to free her from the chains of a non-functional marriage. So the truth is that's not a correct statement. That if you look in the Gemara, there are a number of places in the Gemara where the Gemara assumes that the category of aguna and the need to be lenient with respect to aguna applies in the latter case as well. It applies even in the case of a man who is leaving and he's alive, and we're afraid that the wife is going to end up being an aguna because the husband is not giving her a get. If you look in source number one, you find in Maseches Gittin on Daf Yotes Amud Beis, there is a special leniency even in the way that we allow witnesses to sign on a get. A man is giving his wife a get, and the only witnesses who are available to sign on the get are witnesses who don't know how to sign their name properly, even though when it comes to other contracts, we would require that they know how to sign. When it comes to a get, we say that we can draw an outline for them of their signature, and they can fill out the outline in order to be able to sign the get properly. And why is it that we're so lenient? Because we're worried that if they're the only people who are available, then we have to worry, that we have to wait for other witnesses to come along who do know had to sign their name properly. By the time those other witnesses come along, it could be that the husband will be gone. It could be that he's not going to want to give the get anymore. He won't be available to give the get anymore. And therefore, in order not to suffer such a consequence, there is a special leniency that we draw the outline for the witnesses to sign their signature. And the Gemara says explicitly, what's the reason for this special takana? So the Gemara says, Shelo Yehu Benos Yisrael Agunot, that the women, the daughters of Israel, should not be Agunot. That even in a regular get situation, we have leniencies that apply to the actual get itself in order to prevent a woman from being an Aguna. In fact, to this very day, we have this sense of immediacy. Whenever there is a tense divorce situation where a husband is reluctant to write a get, and then he finally agrees to give the get, so we have all kinds of leniencies, even though the chatzila in the ideal world, we would write all the gittin during the daytime and not at night, because a get might be similar to a din Torah, which is supposed to be during the day. We say we relax that requirement. If the man agrees only at 2 in the morning to write a get, so then you wake up the scribe, you wake up the witnesses, you say you gotta get over to the Beis Din office and write the get, even if it's 2 in the morning. There is a preference for a get not to be written on Erev Shabbos, on Friday, also because Dinei Torah aren't supposed to ideally take place on Friday. But nowadays, Rav Henkin already wrote a number of years ago, Rav Yosef Henkin, who was one of the premier poskim in America in the mid part of the 20th century. So Rav Henkin wrote that every situation nowadays is a shas hadchak. Every single situation is an emergency situation, and whenever there's just a preference to do things a certain way, but it'll be kosher if you do things a different way. So you do things in any which way in which the get will be kosher, even if it means that you write the get on Erev Shabbos, you write the get at night, any which way in which you can assure that there will be a kosher get. There was a tragic story I remember in the Midwest when I recall hearing about when I was working as the director of the Beit Din of America, that they had convened the husband and the wife for a get. And it was late in the day, and they were about to give over the get and noticed that a mistake had been made in the writing of the get. So it was such a serious mistake that the get couldn't be given over because it would not have been a kosher get. And they had to write another get, but at that point, apparently, they had made a couple of mistakes in a previous get, and this was already a second get, and the sofer, the scribe, was too tired to write another get. He said, it's going to be too hard to write another get. So they sent everybody home and said, okay, we'll come back the next day, and we'll write another get tomorrow. In the meantime, when the husband came home, he got on the phone with some of his friends, and the friend said to him, why are you giving your wife a get? You can, don't you realize that if you hold out on the get, you'll be able to pressure her to giving you better arrangements in terms of your child custody, and you'll have some more leverage and negotiating power. So the husband listened to his friends and said, okay, that sounds like good advice to me. I'm not going to give my wife a get. I'm going to hold out for better terms in terms of the parenting arrangements. And the next day, he didn't come in to write the get. And years later, they were still fighting over whether he would come to write the get. So the lesson, the moral of the story is that just like the Gemara said, Shelo Yehu Benos Yisrael Agunot, you make sure that you use even the witnesses who don't know how to sign properly by making an outline that they can fill in, so too you can never squander an opportunity to write a get immediately, because you never know what might happen if a person has another evening to think about giving a get. This is always a very tense type of determination, because I remember at the Beis Din, sometimes we were in a difficult position where it wasn't clear whether a husband would ever come back again, and we'd have to figure out whether the circumstances that we were dealing with were such that we had the ability to persuade the husband to give a get, and if so, whether we could persuade him to give a get that would be kosher according to halacha. I remember there was one fellow who came into the Beis Din, and he hadn't been giving his wife a get. And he walked into the Beis Din one day, and he said, "I just want to tell you that I'm here so nobody can claim that I'm making my wife an aguna." So I said, "Wonderful, so you're ready to write a get?" He said, no, I'm here so that it should be clear that I'm not making wife an aguna because I showed up." So I said, "Well, what good is that? You're just showing up, and that doesn't take away her aguna status." So he said, "Well, you know, there's a court case somewhere, and I'm prepared to authorize a get to be given, and but it can't be delivered until the conclusion of that particular court case." So I was thinking to myself that here is a fellow that had been holding out on giving a get. He's prepared to authorize the get, but on the other hand, he is stipulating that the get shouldn't be delivered until the conclusion of the court case. And who knows if this court case is even genuine? Who knows if the whole story is one that can be relied upon? So after doing a little bit of research, I determined that it wasn't something that was so reliable. And it was very possible that as the basis of this authorization, we'd write a get, and then we'd be in a position that we'd never be able to deliver the get. And the man would be able to say, "Well, I'm not making my wife an aguna because I wrote a get." But then it would be an undeliverable get. So sometimes the Beis Din has to make a calculation that they might get one shot to do a get. And if the one shot that they get, they end up writing a get, a Jewish bill of divorce that can't be delivered or that isn't going to be kosher, according to any authority, so then it's better off and not writing a get at all and waiting a little bit. On the other hand, if you can write a get that's going to work, that's going to meet the minimal threshold, so then you don't want to squander the opportunity. So that was one of the few instances I remember where we came to the conclusion it was better not to write the get, because if we would write it, it probably might very likely never be deliverable, and that might be the one shot that we would get. So we had to work harder on that particular case, and thank God, about a year later, the get was given over in proper fashion. Those are very vexing decisions that a Beis Din has to make. But that's part of what it means to work on behalf of the daughters of Israel. Shelo Yehu Benos Yisrael Agunot. So the next question really is whether the premise of this discussion is a correct premise, that whenever you have a situation where a husband is withholding a get, is it by definition an evil thing? Is it by definition something that has to be ameliorated? Or could anyone ever make the claim that under some circumstances maybe it could be appropriate to withhold the get? Is it ever appropriate? You say, can somebody act in such a morally repugnant fashion that a husband would say, "I'm not going to be willing to give a get"? So I think that it's just very important here to establish a bright line rule that I think is consistent with the preponderance of rabbinic literature, that the answer is it is never appropriate to withhold a get. That if a marriage is over, if a couple is not living together, and even one person, just the wife, wants out of the marriage, she doesn't want to be with her husband anymore, she doesn't like him anymore, she's not interested, even if she's at fault, even if one can make the argument that she's at fault, maybe she's done terrible things to him, maybe she's violated the halacha of going to Beis Din and she's gone to secular court to litigate all of her disputes with him instead of Beis Din. A get should never be used as a weapon, it should never be used as a negotiating tool, it should never be used as a leverage at the conclusion of a marriage. There are other devices that can be utilized if somebody's not acting properly. If we have a case in the Beis Din where two people have a monetary dispute, one person wants to go to Beis Din and the other person refuses to come to Beis Din, so they can be held in contempt. So a siruv is issued against him. There could be a contempt order issued against the person who refuses to come to Beis Din, and the other person can litigate the monetary disputes in secular court. So that would be a heter or kos, a rishus, a permission that would be given. But to say that because one person isn't acting properly, so therefore the other person can shame them for the rest of their lives, that they can prevent them from moving on with their life and to be a naguna, so that's something which is completely unconscionable. That gives a special advantage to somebody just because the Torah created a halacha that a husband is supposed to give his wife a get at the conclusion of the marriage. If you look at source number three, which is a quotation from Moshe Feinstein, but Moshe Feinstein says that whenever it's clear to a Beis Din, she'ef shalasa shalom b'neim, that it's impossible to create shalom bayis, that it's impossible to reconcile the marriage. As midina Torah ba'ofen kazem mechuachem lehisgarish. Under these circumstances, it is obligatory for both parties to cooperate with respect to a divorce. Ve'ein reshus l'shum sad la'agen lo'abalas ishto v'lo'a isha sabal. And it's never appropriate for either side to hold up the other side, not the woman to refuse to accept the get, and not the man to refuse to give a get to his wife. So this is, I think, the upshot, essentially, of our philosophical perspective towards the entire enterprise of get issues at the end of a marriage. Whenever it's clear that the marriage is no longer functional, so then, regardless of whatever other disputes are out there, the appropriate thing, the right thing to do, is for the wife to accept a get, and for the husband to give his wife a get. That is the Derech HaTorah. That is the way of life that the Torah requires of us. That we don't believe in keeping another party captive. It happens that there was a New York Times article that was published a couple of years ago regarding a particular Aguna dispute. Might even have involved someone in this community. I wasn't directly contacted by the New York Times when they published the article, but they quoted something that I had written when they were speaking about the get dispute. I think it's the only time that my name ever appeared in the New York Times. I'm not looking for the publicity. Usually it's better to stay out of the New York Times. So the particular quotation that they cited was as follows. I had written in an article for Jewish Action over 10 years ago, I had written, it is never correct for either the husband to withhold a get or for the wife to refuse a get when a marriage is clearly over. A very succinct statement, which I think accurately summarizes our position. So the reporter called me up afterwards to apologize for not checking with me before quoting me. I wasn't called in particular, specifically in connection with this case. Just found this quotation of mine, I suppose, somewhere over the internet. So I said that no apology was necessary. I thought it was a very nice quote that anybody is free to use. And I thought a good expression of basically our hashkafa when it comes to these issues. But given that this is our hashkafa, and it's not only, I gave you one source from Moshe Feinstein, you can find other sources as well. There's a Ramah in Yoredeya and Simon Reish Chav Ches, Sif Chav, if you want to look it up. It's clear that this is our moral compass when it comes to these issues. We don't believe in holding anybody up as a hostage in the context of their marriage. If the marriage is over, whether the husband likes it or not, of course he should give his wife a get. I had a case in California where there was a man who was not giving his wife a get because she had gone to litigate all the issues of the divorce in civil court. And he had a Beis Din that had issued a siruv, had issued a contempt order against the wife for refusing to go to civil court. So he argued, how could he be forced to give a get when there's a contempt order against his wife? It happens that I instituted a policy when I was at the Beit Din of America that we wouldn't issue a contempt order against a woman for refusing to go to Beis Din if the husband hadn't given her a get in the context of a divorce. Because I would always say to the husband, if you want a contempt contempt order against your wife for not acting properly, by not litigating and besting. You have to show, b'nikah ha'ish me'avon, you have to show that you have clean hands. How will you show that you have clean hands? If you do the morally correct thing, you give her a get. Once you've given her a get, so that everybody is on equal, proper footing, so then if she's refusing still to come to Besdin to litigate these issues, so then we'll issue a contempt order against your wife, and you'll have the normal remedies of any case where somebody's refusing to come to Besdin and there's a contempt order issued against them. So that was always my policy, remains the policy to this day at the Betdin of America. It's a policy that I discussed with the person who was the author in Eretz Yisrael. Somebody wrote a book for the Otzer HaPoskim series on issues of when and when not a get can be compelled, and what's considered to be compelling a get and what's not considered to be compelling a get. It's called Kafia Beget, written by Rotzvi Gartner. So I met once in my office with Rotzvi Gartner, and I discussed this policy with Rotzvi Gartner to see if he was in approval of this policy. He said he was 100% in approval of this policy. So that was our policy. But not every Besdin had this policy. So one Besdin issued a contempt order against this woman because she had gone to civil court, but the husband hadn't yet given her a get. So the husband, in the meantime, wanted to get on with his life. So he found himself another woman, and he wanted to marry her. Only problem is that there's a halacha that Rabbeinu Gershom instituted a takana, Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom, that a man, even though according to biblical law, he's allowed to be married to multiple wives, according to rabbinic law, he's not allowed to be married to multiple wives. So how do you get around this Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom? So somehow, the rabbis, he found some rabbis who had no problem getting around this claim of the Rabbeinu Gershom. They said, the first wife isn't acting properly, so you don't have to give her a get, but why should you be stopped from getting on with your life? So we'll let you marry a second wife. So he had a wedding ceremony in which he got married to another woman. So I found out about this. It was brought to my attention. We didn't normally interfere with cases that were dealt with by other Batei Din, but it was clear that this was such an avla, this was such a perversion of Torah justice that it required action. So we found out who the people were that were involved, and we pointed out to them that this is completely unacceptable. Even in those instances where a man could be permitted to override the Chayim de Rabbeinu Gershom, that's when you have a woman who unfortunately is suffering from dementia and she's incapable of receiving a get. But here you have a woman who's ready, willing, and able to receive a get. There is no justification for permitting the man to remarry without his first having to give a get to the first wife. And we sent the letters and made phone calls and made a whole tumult about this. And finally, the various rabbis realized, who are involved, realized the mistake of the situation, and they rectified the mistake and required him to give a get to his first wife. So that was taken care of. But according to Torah morality, this type of abuse, this type of position is completely and totally unacceptable. So then the question is, what steps do you really have in your power to take when a husband is not doing the morally correct thing, when he's not acting according to the hashkafa of the Torah, when marriage is over, and because he's so angry at his wife, he's spiteful for whatever, or maybe he's interested in using the get as a weapon to get other concessions, he's refusing to give a get to his wife. So what is possible to do according to halacha? So the first response is, well, don't we know that you're allowed to beat a man up to give his wife a get? So the answer is, no, you're not allowed to beat a man up to give his wife a get. The Torah says, the Rambam quotes this, the Rambam says that from the Pasuk in the Torah that talks about how a get is given, that it's a decision, it's a voluntary decision. The husband decides he doesn't want to remain with the wife, so he writes her a get. So we see a get has to be given of the husband's free will. Everything, every kind of contractual arrangement is supposed to be made of a person's free will. That's obvious, but there's even an additional pasuk. There's a very high level of das. There's a very high level of voluntary commitment that needs to be made with respect to the giving of a get. And if a get is given through coercion, through forcing the husband to give a get, so then the get is not considered to be valid according to Jewish law. That's considered to be a get me'usa. So why is it that people are under the impression that you're allowed to beat the husband up to give his wife a get? So that's because in certain cases, the Gemara indicates you can beat the husband up to give his wife a get. But those are only very few cases. The Rambam gives an explanation that sometimes the situation is so egregious. Like you have a man who's a mukashkin, that when he walks on the street, pieces of his body fall off. Because he just has such a physically abominable condition. So no person in the right mind would want to be married to such a man. You have a man who's a roe zonos, that he frequents prostitution houses. So you have a man who's constantly beating his wife. So these are things where, objectively speaking, there are opinions that amongst the rabbinic authorities that nobody in their right mind could say that anybody would want to live with somebody like that. So therefore, we would coerce the man to give his wife a get. And the Rambam explains that when coercion is allowed, the reason for that is because we don't really consider it to be coercion. That a person deep down wants to follow the Torah and the mitzvos. Sometimes their yetzer hara gets in the way, and so what we're really doing is we're beating out their yetzer hara. We're beating the yetzer hara out of these people so that they'll remember what it is that they really want to do. So that's the explanation that the Rambam gives. That's source number 6, the Rambam in Hilchos Gerushin at the end of Perek Beis, the second chapter of the Laws of Divorce of Hilchos Gerushin in the Rambam. However, there are many cases where you don't have these objective criteria present, where if you just have what might be called in secular parlance irreconcilable differences. It's not that objectively speaking nobody would want to be married to the man. Objectively speaking, what he does is so clearly repulsive. It's just he's repulsive to the wife. She doesn't like him anymore. They're emotionally split apart. Or sometimes the wife may be the instigator of the problem. Maybe he's a very nice fellow and she wants somebody who's a little nastier. Maybe he's not good looking enough for her. Whatever the reasons, there may be cases where the motivation for the divorce is not necessarily because the man is objectively repugnant to the degree that coercion would be warranted. What if the case simply is where the woman says, "Ma'isalai is repugnant to me. I find that he's not a good emotional partner for me. I don't find him to be attractive in his personality and our interaction and our compatibility." So the Rambam, it happens, essentially incorporates what was a takana at the time of the Gaonim. The Gaonim who lived in the periods around the 9th, 10th century and so forth. So the Gaonim made a rule that in order to rescue the Agunot, you see that this was a concern going through all the generations, they would allow kefir. They would allow for coercion even in cases where a woman says Moi Solai. Even when she says that the husband's repugnant to me, and we look at the husband and he seems like a nice fellow. He comes to Shir every, he comes to Minyan every morning, goes to Daf Yomi. We don't notice anything wrong with him, but the wife says, I can't stand living with him anymore. But the preponderance of rabbinic opinion was not in accordance with the Gaonim. The preponderance of rabbinic opinion was like that of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam is quoted in source number 7, and in other places, Rabbeinu Tam said, if a woman says Ma'isolai, if she says that a man is repugnant to her, so that's not sufficient to warrant coercion. However, Rabbeinu Tam, in another book that he authored called the Sefer HaYosher, the Sefer of those who are straight and upright, So Rabbeinu Tam himself writes that even though we don't allow coercion, but we allow other measures to be taken, because even Rabbeinu Tam was not a male chauvinist. He was not a misogynist. Rabbeinu Tam was not out to stick it to the women. He just felt that a get that would be given under coercion under such circumstances would not be a valid get. But he tried to come up with other valid ways that pressure could be put upon the husband. So Rabbeinu Tam made a famous distinction between the imposition of a penalty. If you're going to penalize somebody, or you're going to hurt them, put a gun to their head, take away money from them, so that could result in a coerced get. But on the other hand, if you have simply a withholding of benefits, that it's not that you're penalizing the person, you're just withholding certain benefits and privileges from the person, so that, Rabbeinu Tam said, is an effective and a legitimate way to bring about a husband to give a get to his wife. So Rav Abadya Yosef, in source number 9, was dealing with a case where a husband was refusing to give his wife a get. And he quoted from what's called these distancing measures, the halachos, the Rabbeinu Tam of Rabbeinu Tam. And he quotes, Shelo yu rashaim ledaber imo, that you can have a community-wide ordinance that nobody is allowed to speak to this person. Below the oracle, or to host this person for Shabbos meals, or to invite them to their bar mitzvahs or their weddings. U'la'achilu la'ashkosula bosula bakwa b'choyer, if this person's sick, then they are not even allowed to visit them in the hospital. And the Rav Avadya Yosef said that the list of Rabbeinu Tam is not exhaustive. You can come up with other things as well. Sha'alko, he says, Ve'hosafnu alechumos, then in the case he was dealing with, they imposed all of those measures, and they added additional measures. Sha'alko, gabai batei ekneses, that all of the gabayim of all of the shuls should all agree, shlo la'ashivo beveis ekneses, that they're not going to allow him to have membership in the shul, they're not going to allow him to come into the shul. Ve'shlo la'aloso, he won't have a seat in the shul. Mishlola aloso l'sefer Torah, they won't call him up for an aliyah. Mishlo lisho b'shlomo, and then nobody will say good Shabbos to him. Velo lachlok lo shum kavod, and they won't convey any type of honor upon him. Olisrachik me'olav gechola efshar, and that they will distance themselves from him in every possible way. Ad asher yikana lebavo v'yishma lekomorim, until his heart has been humbled and he will listen to the various community leaders. And he will give a get to his wife, Kedas Moshe of Israel, according to the laws of Moses in Israel, and to free her from her state of being an aguna. It's the last few lines of the source number 9. And he even mentions that this was an official psak of a Beis Din panel that he sat on, together with other luminaries of the generation, Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, who is the author of the Tzitz Eliezer, and Rabbi Yitzchak Kolitz, and that Beis Din decided that they would implement the Halachos de Rabbeinu Tam. So that really is something which is at our disposal nowadays to be able to do in situations, even when coercive measures are not feasible. The truth of the matter is, from a legal perspective, even if the Torah would authorize putting a gun to a husband's head, it's not clear that one would be able to do so anyway if they're living in a government where it would be a crime to put a gun to a husband's head to say, we're going to shoot you if you don't give your wife a get. But the truth is that even short of that, most situations, according to the halacha in Shulchan Aruch, were not warrants outright coercion anyway. But halachos to Rabbeinu Tam, when you're dealing with an emergency type of situation, so these types of halachos, these types of distancing measures, what we call withholding of benefits, could be completely appropriate. And certainly, the notion of having measures where there are protest rallies in front of a person's home or place of business, bringing about a certain level of embarrassment to remind the person of what their moral obligations are, so that they will hopefully remember to do the right thing, but those are not considered to be duress at all, according to halacha. Duress is if you beat somebody up, and according to most poskim, if you take money away from the person as well. But short of that, these measures would not be considered duress, especially since the person has the ability to run to a different place where they wouldn't be subject to these types of distancing measures. They can usually find refuge somewhere. It's a pretty big world. So therefore, this is not considered to be coercion from the standpoint of halakha. So this was a frustration when I was working at the Besdin. And what we noticed is that sometimes we would issue contempt decrees against a man who was refusing to cooperate and refusing to give his wife a get. But the contempt decree didn't necessarily accomplish much. It's just something you could post on a wall that the Beis Din had put somebody in contempt. Usually there was very little that was done with it. So the wife would have a piece of paper that was sent by the Beis Din. We summoned this man to come to Beis Din, and he refused to show up or to abide by the decision of the Beis Din if we told him that he should give a get. So there wasn't much that the woman could do with that piece of paper, particularly in the majority of cases when the man would refuse to come to Beis Din altogether. So there was a fellow, I will mention his name, Leshevach, by the name of Josh Ross, who was then a student at Yeshiva University, who came to me when I was working at the Beis Din, and he said that he wanted to do something to help Agunot, and he wanted to assemble a group that would, whenever the Beis Din would issue a contempt order, would take appropriate measures to bring about pressure so that the husband would realize that it was appropriate to give his wife a get, so that he would actually give a get, so there would be some sort of an enforcement arm of the decrees and the declarations of the Beis Din. So I said to Josh at that point in time that this was an excellent idea, because that's something the community really lacked. There were Aguna advocacy organizations, but they were more involved, from what I could tell, with arguing that whatever was being done wasn't enough, rather than getting involved in trying to bring about resolutions in individual situations according to the halakhic framework of the Beis Din. And that's not to cast aspersions. I'm just describing the reality. So I told him that there were two different steps that he needed to take in order for this to be a successful enterprise. Number one, they'd have to make sure that they had top-notch legal counsel. Because if you're going to get involved with protest rallies and putting pressure on people and calling them up and doing things of that sort, there are laws that could potentially be implicated, and they'd have to be very careful not to violate any laws in terms of how they went about doing their business. And number two, I advised them that they should have impeccable halakha counsel. I think I recommended Rav Schechter to be the halakhic counsel for whatever organization would be formed. So he was a very good listener. So he took my advice in both areas and formed the organization that became known as ORA, as the Organization for the Resolution of Agunot, hence the name ORA. And that organization then took it upon itself, with consultation with halakhic authorities, that whenever a Beis Din issued a decree which indicated that a person was in contempt, either because they weren't coming to Beis Din altogether or because they weren't listening to the decree of Beis Din, that they, as a community organization, would see to it that appropriate measures would be carried out in accordance with the halakha, in accordance with the parameters that would be allowed in an individual situation based on halakhos d'Rabbeinu Tam, and that would be consistent with legal requirements as well. And their interventions brought about, helped to bring about gittin in many, many cases where there previously had been problems. And I think Ad HaYom HaZeh, it has been a tremendous force of assistance for Agunot within the community. But as they say, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Sometimes an ounce of prevention is worth many, many tons of cure. And the best thing is to create a framework where there wouldn't even be the potential for Aguna situations to occur altogether. So it used to be that there were less aguna problems, and one of the reasons that there were less aguna problems of this sort, of recalcitrant husbands refusing to give their wives a get, was because the Besdin of different communities had more authority, that it was more automatic that whenever there was some type of a dispute, the people would come to Besdin, and then Besdin would have the authority to issue a decision and say to the man, you have to give a get, and then that decision would be capable of being carried out. In a free country, thank God we live in a free country, there is separation between religion and state, and therefore Besdin does not have automatic jurisdiction to just bring husbands to come into the Besdin. So therefore, what was recommended, I'll jump a little bit because I want to jump to the things that actually work. If you look in source number 18, already Rav Moshe Feinstein, the preeminent posek for American Jewry in the 20th century, but Moshe Feinstein endorsed the notion of having a prenuptial agreement, and the prenuptial agreement that was explicitly endorsed by Rav Moshe Feinstein was essentially an arbitration agreement, where the parties entering into a marriage would stipulate that in the event that they would ever have a dispute regarding a divorce and regarding the giving of a get, that they agreed to submit to a specific Besdin. That would give the Besdin authority to bring the parties in front of the Besdin and to issue a decision. That type of an arbitration agreement is binding both from the perspective of halacha and, very importantly, also from the perspective of secular law. According to secular law, two parties who are getting married could sign an agreement saying, if we have a dispute at the time of our divorce, we agree we're going to go to a Besdin. They can even limit it to a dispute with respect to a get. Say, if we have a dispute with respect to a get, we agree that we're going to go to the following Besdin, and the Besdin, we will listen to whatever the Besdin says. And if the Besdin says that a get has to be given, so then a get can be given. And there's a famous New York case which ruled that this type of an arbitration provision, even though it relates to a religious obligation, is enforceable because the notion of arbitrating a dispute before an arbitration tribunal, regardless of the subject matter, is a principle of neutral application, is something which is not religiously based in its essential nature. And that case was called Avitzur v. Avitzur, where the parties had incorporated a prenuptial agreement into their ketubah. But there was such an arbitration agreement that said they would go to a Besdin if there was a dispute about giving a divorce, and the court ruled that, so this was the highest court in New York, ruled that that was an enforceable provision. So therefore, that's the first step. Even with this agreement alone, that has the capacity of resolving many aguna problems. I remember one case where a couple had signed an agreement of this sort, and the husband ran off to the Netherlands, Netherlands. So he was far away from his wife, and he wasn't giving her a get. And then the wife appointed a long-distance lawyer to represent her in the court in the Netherlands, and this long-distance attorney brought a copy of the prenuptial agreement that she had signed, saying that if there's a dispute about the giving of a get, they agreed to submit to the jurisdiction of the Betin of America and listen to what the Betin had to say. And the judge in the Netherlands, based on this agreement, said that the husband was obligated to report to the Besdin in New York to take care of this particular matter. And because of that ruling by the judge in the Netherlands and the fact that they had signed this prenuptial agreement, even though all it said was just that he had to show up in front of the Besdin, it didn't say he had to give a get, just say he had to show up in front of the Besdin, but that enabled him to show up in front of the Besdin and for the Besdin to arrange for him to take care of the get. He didn't want any problems. He had this agreement out there, so he figured he'll take care of whatever he has to take care of. So it says he has to go to the Besdin, he'll go to the Besdin, he'll give the get, he'll take care of the whole thing. 90% of success in life, somebody once said, I think is showing up, right? So you get the person to show up, so that's already 90% of the success of taking care of the problem. But in addition, there is another measure that can be taken in terms of the in terms of prenuptial agreements between the parties that can help to ensure the timely giving of the get. And that's based on a form by a great rabbinic authority a few hundred years ago by the name of the Nachla Shiva. The Nachla Shiva was somebody who was a gaon. He was a great rabbi, but he also collected legal forms. In New York, if you want a legal form, so you pick up what's called a Bloomberg form, right? I don't think it has anything to do with Mayor Bloomberg. But there's a Bloomberg, you got Bloomberg forms, which give you any kind of contractual form that you need for any transaction. When I worked as an attorney, so I was put on some sort of committee, or I was appointed by some sort of committee of the Bar Association of New York to work on the official real estate contract. For the state of New York, because they were revising the real estate contract for just the sale of a property at that point in time. So it might still be the form that's in use today. So if you see it, so I don't think I was allowed to put my initials on it, but I helped to draft the revised form of a standard real estate contract. So I think that's the Bloomberg form. So you go to the Bloomberg form, so that's the real estate contract form. So and the Nachla Shiva had forms for all kinds of different transactions, and he had forms for Tanoim. He had forms for marriage contracts. And one of the marriage contract forms that he had was the, what he called the Tanoim Achronim, the various terms and stipulations entered into between husband and wife at the time that they got married. We have Tanoim nowadays, too. Our Tanoim hardly say anything when people get married. It used to be that Tanoim was a long litany of all kinds of serious obligations that would be entered into between the husband-to-be and the wife-to-be and their parents, all kinds of monetary obligations and penalty clauses, all kinds of very scary things. Nowadays, the Tanoim just say the parties are together and they're all lovey-dovey and we're about to get married and isn't it wonderful and here we sign. So it doesn't say that much nowadays. It says a little bit, but it doesn't say that much. So it used to be the Tanoim was a much more serious exercise. So he had a form of Tanoim where in the Tanoim it basically said that in the event that there would be a ketata, there would be a dispute between the husband and the wife. So normally the husband is obligated to support his wife when she's living at home. But you don't normally quantify that obligation. You don't say it's $50 a day, $100 a day, $150 a day, because support happens mimela. Support happens automatically. A couple's living together in a functional, normal marriage. So somehow the bills get paid, or somehow the credit card debts get incurred. But whatever, the support is provided, that food is bought, and clothing is bought, and the rent is paid, the mortgage is paid, there is a support that is automatically provided. Nobody ever has to quantify it. However, in the event that a couple is separated, and because they had a quarrel, and now they're separated from each other, then you have to quantify it. Then you have to figure out what's the amount of money that the husband's going to provide for the wife in order for her to be able to fend for herself while they're separated from each other. So his form said that in the event that they're separated, so a certain sum of money will be provided every single day until they come to Beis Din, and Beis Din will figure out what to do, whether Beis Din's going to reconcile the marriage or whether they're going to get divorced. But at least while they're married, according to Jewish law, they're separated, he's going to pay her this sum of money every single day. So the Nachla Shiva had such a form that people would sign when they would get married. So the Beis Din of America, through the draftsmanship of Rabbi Mordechai Willig, revived this form of the Nachla Shiva a number of years ago. And basically this is included in the standard prenuptial agreement form that basically just says that in the event that the couple is separated, the husband is going to pay a quantifiable support obligation every single day. The husband waives any rights that he may have according to halacha to his wife's earnings during that period, which he's allowed to do. And therefore it becomes a reasonable support obligation, not a penalty. A penalty could be a problem, right? As we said, we can't have a coerced get that is brought about by taking somebody's money away from them. This is money that's appropriate for him to pay anyway, because it's calculated in accordance with a normal support obligation of $150 a day, approximately $1,000 a week. That's consistent with the socioeconomic class that most people get married within the community of what it costs to support somebody over the course of a year. And this provides another incentive for the husband to give the wife a get as quickly as possible, so he won't have to keep on paying this amount of money for her support. So I had a couple, I remember early on, in the Beis Din, and we had this scenario repeat itself many times. There were dozens and dozens of cases. I used to make a note. I used to have a ledger, which I kept a tab of every single time that there was a prenuptial agreement that would have been entered into between the parties, when that was helpful in terms of bringing bringing about a timely get. And it was dozens and dozens of cases, close to 100 cases by the time I left the Beis Din, which I knew about. There may have been more cases I didn't even know about, but I would always make a note whenever it happened. So I remember early on, I saw how this would play out. There was a woman who went to Stern College for Women, our women's college at Yeshiva University, and she met a fellow who was had not been observant. He became observant in order to marry her, basically, and then the marriage fell apart, so since he only became observant to marry her, so he had no reason to remain observant from his perspective, so he gave up his Torah observance, and she wanted a get, but he didn't like her anymore, so he didn't want to give her a get, so you figure maybe he needs the get for himself. He didn't need the get for himself. He wasn't observant. He was happy to marry somebody who wouldn't care whether or not he had a get. He would get civilly married to somebody who wasn't religious at all, or not even Jewish at all. So the get wasn't important from his perspective, and he came in, we scheduled the get. So we asked him, the first question you have to ask when you do a get is, are you giving the get of your own free will and accord? So he said, well, to be honest, I would never give her again in a million years. I want her to just stay at home and rot because I'm angry at her. But my lawyer told me, since I signed this Schlagener prenuptial agreement at the time that we got married, so it looks like I'm obligated to pay a certain amount of support every single day, and who knows, if it was taken to court, it might actually be enforceable, so in order not to have that headache, I'm giving her the get. So I said, good, so that's voluntary, because you're making a voluntary decision. You can either support her, remain married to her, and continue to support her, which is appropriate, or you can decide you don't want to support her anymore and give her again. You're deciding to do the latter, your own free will and accord. He said, yeah, I guess so. And that's considered to be a voluntary get. But I can tell you that if not for the prenuptial agreement, so this woman who may have had a headache for a couple of months while the marriage was falling apart and while she was working out the get, but that was a headache that Baruch Hashem passed after a couple of months. She would still have that headache today, possibly, 13 years later. And who knows how many other cases would fall into that category. So if we have a device that, halakhically speaking, can work, even if it wasn't always employed, even if 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, people weren't always signing it, but we know that we have a problem, we know that we have a halakhically feasible solution that we can employ, so then we have a genuine obligation. When there's a rabbinic way, there has to be a rabbinic will. We have a genuine obligation to utilize this device in order to prevent aguna situations, and if we don't utilize the device, then it's probably rabbinic malpractice, and it's probably community malpractice if we don't push for things that can really ameliorate and prevent the aguna situation. So these are real life solutions. The ounce of prevention is the prenuptial agreement. The pounds of cure, if there aren't a prenuptial agreement, are sometimes more difficult. But it certainly requires community pressure in those situations where a man is refusing to give a get, and to utilize measures, obviously with the authorization of a Beis Din, but to utilize measures such as the Hachakos, the Rabbeinu Tam, withholding of benefits to whatever degree is appropriate. Even in New York, they went so far as to bring in the support of the secular government in terms of instituting legislation that would be helpful in terms of bringing about Gittin. The Gemara in Gittin, at the very end of the Gemara in Gittin, talks about utilizing secular courts precisely for this purpose. When the Beis Din says that a get should be given, so then a secular court can be utilized to say, "Asei mashi Yisrael omim lecha," do what the Jews are telling you to do. The Beis Din told you to give a get, so you got to give a get. So that's considered to be perfectly legitimate. So you can utilize the secular courts legitimately, even when the situation doesn't allow for coercion. It can allow for withholding of benefits. So Moshe also wrote, this is in the last source, that's source number 19. So Moshe wrote that to have some sort of a law let's say a husband filed for divorce and he wants a civil divorce, so you'd say to the husband that you're not entitled to the civil divorce unless you first give your wife a get. So Moshe said that's a perfectly legitimate law, because there's no halacha, the Moshe Misinai, that he's entitled to a civil divorce. That's a benefit. So we say we're going to withhold that benefit from you until such time as he gives you, so your wife, a get. That's considered to be perfectly legitimate. So that type of a device can be utilized says Moshe. And that was basically the background of Get Law Number 1 in the state of New York, and that's really essentially what Get Law Number 1 says. Now, there was a Get Law Number 2. Get Law Number 2 was more dangerous because it incorporated language that said that if somebody's not giving a get, then a court can take that into account, or even should take that into account, in terms of figuring out how the assets should be divided. So that might be considered, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Rabbi Yosef El Yoshev, Rabbi Yosef Shlomo Yoshev thought that was a problem of coercion. If the husband would otherwise get 50% of the assets and now he'll get 0% of the assets because he's not giving his wife a get, that could be viewed as taking money away from him that otherwise would have belonged to him. So that was more problematic. So that's why get law number two hasn't really been utilized as much. You have to be very careful with all of the halakhic solutions. There have been other proposals that have been made over the years. So I have in the various sources proposals of saying that a woman never would have married the man had she known that he wouldn't give her a get, and therefore the marriage is null and void. So that doesn't really work because a woman goes into a marriage like anybody goes into a transaction with their eyes open. Maybe it will work out and maybe it won't work out. Just like you can't undo a business transaction. Had I known the stock would go down, I never would have bought the stock. I want my money back. So it doesn't work. So the same thing is true with respect to a marriage. There are some egregious cases where you can say that something was withheld from a woman and nobody in their right mind ever would have gotten married had they known this about the man, and it's a condition that exists at the time of marriage. Like, for example, when Moshe has a tshuva, the man was a practicing homosexual. So he says, no woman, regardless how progressive you might be on the subject, he said, no woman would want it when she gets married, and she's interested in marrying a man. She has, she's interested in having a traditional marriage relationship. She's no woman, it can be presumed, would want to marry a man who's more interested in being with men than she'd be interested in being with women. So you need sort of four conditions. The woman didn't know about the floor at the time of marriage. The floor existed at the time of marriage. Not that the man had the potential to become a jerk and later on he became. Everyone has the potential of being a jerk. It's the human condition. I mean, you wouldn't marry anybody if you were worried about someone who has the potential of being a jerk. But it has to be a very serious condition that exists at the time of marriage. And it has to be a condition that is so serious that no woman in her right mind would marry such a man, or can be so presumed, like a man who's shatu for Mishko Zohar. He prefers men over women. And as soon as the woman finds out about the floor, she immediately leaves the marriage. So if you have all of those combinations, then it's possible, but Moshe says, if you have a situation where the man's refusing to give a get, so yeshama lismoch, then in those types of cases, the Bezdin might make a determination that was kiddushei tos. But most cases, that there was a mistake in the creation of the marriage. But most cases don't fall into that category of a mistake in the creation of the marriage. And another solution that was proposed was a Tanai B'Nisuin. They should make a condition, whenever people get married, a condition that if the marriage ever unravels, so then automatically it'll be considered like they were never married to begin with. So the Gemara says explicitly, Ein Tanai B'Nisuin. That's the source number 10. The Gemara in Yevamos and Daf Kuf Zayin says explicitly that there's no such thing as making a condition at the time of a marriage, because if a couple is living together, it's assumed that any conditions have been waived, and a man wouldn't want his relationship retroactively to be considered to be illegitimate. Is there an exception to that rule? There's one exception to the rule. If the marriage is only taken apart after the man is already dead. What would it matter? If the man's dead, the woman can remarry anyway. So say, no, there's one case where we would want the marriage to be unraveled even after the man is already dead. That's if they had no children and there was a brother who is incapable, a brother of the husband, who's incapable of doing yibum or chalitza. Because if a man dies without any children, then and he has a brother, then the wife, the widow, is not allowed to remarry anybody else until she either marries the brother, which is called yibum, or the brother releases her through a ritual which is called chalitza. And sometimes there's a brother who would not participate in the ritual. He apostatized to another religion, or he's not mentally capable of providing chalitza, or nobody knows his whereabouts. So if that is known about the brother at the time a couple marries, and they make a condition at the time they marry that the whole marriage will be null and void if the husband dies without any children, so that's the one case that the Rama says that you can make it tonight, you can make a condition. And the explanation given by the poskim is because by the time the man, when a man's dead, so he doesn't care if all of his if his relationship is viewed illegitimate when he's already in the grave. He doesn't want his relationship to be viewed as illegitimate when he's still alive, but when he's in the grave, so he doesn't care. So even those who had come up with a proposal to make every single marriage conditional came to the realization that there was no way to provide for that resolution when a man is still in this world and he's still going to be alive, but just refusing to give a get to his wife. But what we see, why do I bring those examples? What we see from those examples is that in neither of those proposals was the door shut entirely. In both of those cases, there were extreme circumstances where one would be able to invoke Kiddushei Tos, right? But Moshe Feinstein has an extreme case where he talks about unraveling a marriage because of a flaw or a fraud in the creation of the marriage. In the case of making a tanai, so we see there is an ability to make a condition if it only relates to chalitza after the man is already dead. So in all of these different possible suggestions that have come up, or at least many of them, it's important to recognize the window, which is still open, because from that window, one might be able to find more light and more possibilities, even as we have to be very careful to preserve the integrity of halacha. But what we see from the prenuptial agreement example is that sometimes it is possible to introduce al pi halacha, in accordance with halachic rules and regulations, solutions that might appear new, but maybe they're just new in terms of their applicability or in terms of their need, that can really create a tremendous tikkun, a tremendous possible resolution for many potential aguna situations. So I'll just close with one story. Do I have 2 minutes to close with a story? Okay. And then you can leave or ask questions or whatever. I know it's already 10:30. I attended an event several years ago. There was a woman in my community who wrote a book about which was essentially a guide for women who were going through the divorce process to inform them about the policies of different batei din that they should go in with their eyes open in terms of figuring out which beis din to go to and what are the different regulations that are followed in different batei din in terms of the timing of the giving of the get, in terms of the way in which they conduct their din Torah proceedings, if they litigate other aspects of the divorce. And the book was called a din handbook, I think it was called. And DIN stood for Demand Integrity Now. The woman had created an organization about batei din called Demand Integrity Now for batei din to be accountable, and she wrote a very nice book, a very nice handbook. The woman's name is Margie Redder. Her husband recently wrote a book where he created an index for the entire Gemara, for the entire Shas, called HaMafteach. So that's her husband. So when she published this book, so she reprinted an article I had written on the subject, and she asked me to say a few words. They had a whole ceremony, a whole book launching ceremony in a law firm. Maybe it was her husband's law firm, and they had a number of speakers at the time. So one of the speakers was Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Weinrib, and Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Weinrib spoke very eloquently. I remember that he quoted a Gemara that was studied in the Daf Yomi just last week. So the Gemara in the Daf Yomi talks about a woman who was suffering. It doesn't say she was an aguna, but she was suffering a very turbulent personal situation, and she went to cry in front of the great Amora Shmuel. And Shmuel did not seem to be paying too much attention to her. So his student Yehuda said, "Lo sabo lamar, aren't you concerned about the pasuk in Mishle that says otem asno mizakas dal, that somebody closes his ears to the crying of a poor person, gamhu yikra b'lo yane, is also going to not have their own prayers answered? Aren't you worried?" And Shmuel responded, "Shinin areshech v'kri areshech v'reshech b'chamimi." He said, I'm not the one in charge in this community. There's a woman who's suffering problems. So there's Ma'ukva. Ma'ukva is the person who's the big boss in town. And he's the one who's responsible for carrying out proper judgment. So the brunt of the punishment is not going to fall on my head. So that's the end of the entire story in the Gemara. So you figure that there's not nothing that you know about that transpired after that little vignette. So Rabbi Weinman pointed out that the Gemara in Baba Basra, Daf Yudam and Beis, tells a different story of a rabbi who got very sick, and he had a near-death or an actual death experience. And then when he came back to life, his father asked him, so what did you see up there? That now you had a chance to see what's on the other side. So what did you see? So he said, Olam hafach ra'isa, you wouldn't believe it, Daddy. Everything is topsy-turvy, upside down. El yodim lamata, the people who are tremendously respected in this world are all the way on the bottom. Mitakton lamala, people who aren't respected are all the way on the top. It's unbelievable. Tosfos there, the commentary Tosfos, quotes from one of the Gaodim, Rabbeinu Hananel, who says that they had a tradition. They had some sort of a Kabbalah that when he talks about those on the bottom being on the top and those on the top being on the bottom, that's a reference to Rabbi Yehuda and Shmuel from the story that I just mentioned. That Shmuel, who had been the Rebbe of Rabbi Yehuda, was somehow on the bottom of Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Yehuda had been the Talmud who stood up for the woman and said, you got to listen to the cries of anguish of this woman. So he was the one who was on the top. So he used that as a moral message for us to take out of that we have to be very, very sensitive to the cries of those who are in anguish, those who have the dimas ha'ashukim, the tears of the oppressed. And I would take it one step further and note that what was the claim of Shmuel? The claim of Shmuel was that I'm not the one in charge over here. There's somebody else who is, as Rashi says, Lo anash and lemisha biyad lishpot. The only one who really is accountable is the great rabbis, the ones who have all the power, who have the ability to do something. I'm not accountable myself. So maybe part of the message that was being conveyed by Rabbeinu Hananel is that none of us have the right when it comes to the Dimasu Ashukim, to the tears of the oppressed, the Managuna, to take that position. That all of us have a responsibility to view ourselves as personally accountable, as personally responsible for doing whatever we can to create an ethical landscape where it becomes crystal clear that whenever a marriage is functionally over, it is completely unacceptable and reprehensible for a husband ever to withhold giving a get to his wife. We have to make that clear in the way that we conduct ourselves. We have to make that clear in the way that we relate to others who are in this type of predicament. Mirz Hashem, then we should all be zoche to bring about what the Maharsha talks about of rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash from Hera V'Yamein.
I'd like to thank Rabbi Reese for his presentation on this important topic. We have time for a couple of questions. We don't have time to take all of the questions. We ask that people ask questions that are related to the topic in the theoretical sense. Please avoid things of a personal nature. Also want to avoid people getting up and making statements. This is an opportunity for questions on a halachic shir. Please be mindful of such. Yes.
Talk for a moment or two about the Rambam's position on Kofin Ratzani.
Okay, so the question was, can I talk for a moment or two about the Rambam's position about Achiyomer Kofin of Achiyomer Rotsa Kofin also Achiyomer Rotsa Ani, that we beat whenever the Gemara authorizes beating up, we can beat somebody up until they say Rotsa Ani, until they say that I want to do it. So what the Rambam means is that the Rambam spells this out, is that as I mentioned earlier, you're beating out the impediment that exists within the person through their Yetzer Hara that prevents them from doing what deep down they really want to do. The Rambam says deep down, everybody wants to follow the mitzvah satorah. Everybody wants to do what Hashem requires them to do. If it's a case where it's crystal clear that a get has to be given, so then we assume that deep deep down, this is what the person wants to do. There's something that's in the way, and we're beating out whatever it is that is in the way. Okay, to what can be this be compared? Even in a case where there is no authorization for coercion, even when it's a case where we're just providing pressure in other ways, such as through the signing of a prenuptial agreement, often it's to rescue somebody against their worst inclinations. Everybody has a good inclination and a bad inclination. It's likely that the bad inclination of a person is more likely to come out when a person is in an emotionally vulnerable state. There was one case, just to illustrate the point, where there was a fellow who signed the prenuptial agreement, not because his bride asked him for it, because he knew about it, and he was a very progressive person, and he wanted to demonstrate to the world how progressive he was. So they signed the prenuptial agreement, and he insisted that they should read the prenuptial agreement underneath the chuppah. So under the chuppah, in addition to reading the ksuba, they called up somebody to read the prenuptial agreement. I guess, you know, the wedding guest must have had a lot of patience. So they read the whole prenuptial agreement underneath the chuppah. And then 2 years later, his own marriage fell apart. So as soon as his own marriage fell apart, he ran to a lawyer because he was in an emotionally vulnerable state. And the first thing the lawyer told him was, make sure you don't give the get, because we got to use the get for leverage. And then the wife's lawyer pointed out to this lawyer that this fellow had signed a prenuptial agreement, even had it read underneath the chuppah, and the prenuptial agreement put all these obligations upon him to pay a support obligation every day. So the lawyer said, why'd you do that? Now you got to give her the get. And then he came to the bez and he gave the get. Was he a bad person? No, he was a very good person. That's why he had the agreement read under the chuppah. But sometimes when a person is in an emotionally vulnerable state, it's a difficult time in their lives, it brings out the worst in them. So the fact that he signed the agreement reminded him of what a good person he was. So then he was able to act in accordance with his best inclinations.
Emily.
I have two questions regarding conditions for annulment and the mistake in the formation of the marriage. Homosexuality is probably a very easy one, but I think there are more subtle ones. For example, if the person turns out to resist rabbinic authority, he's publicly been given the sirus, rabbis from many communities have against, and yet he doesn't. Clearly, if a wife knew that a person would that qualify that somebody is shomer karah?
So again, as I mentioned, the mistake in the formation of the marriage has to be a mistake that exists at the time of the marriage, meaning that the person already has to have a certain condition. For example, the person didn't have the capacity for intimacy with his wife. Let's say that condition arises 10 years after the marriage already begins. So that wouldn't cause the entire marriage to be undone, because at the time that the marriage was contracted, he was perfectly capable of being a good husband. It's just there's a flaw that arose later on in time. If a flaw arises later on in time, that can create a mekach tos, it can create a kiddushei tos, it can create a mistake in marriage, because he didn't have the flaw at the time of marriage. The only flaw he had is that he had the capacity to do bad. Everybody has the capacity to do bad.
May I just finish with the question about when annulment is possible? So, isn't there a certain definition of marriage? The husband owes this to the wife owes this to the husband. If those conditions aren't completed, by definition, they're not married anymore.
Right.
Is there a way to use that kind of logic?
I think you have to distinguish between annulment and grounds for divorce. If a husband is no longer fulfilling his marital duties, so then it's grounds for divorce. So then you can require a divorce. You can say to him, you're obligated to divorce your wife, and you could try to bring about to make sure that he grants her a divorce. But that doesn't create annulment. Annulment is a different concept. Annulment has to be a flaw that was present at the time of the creation of the marriage, and no woman in her right mind that she known about the flaw that existed at the time of the marriage would have married such a man.
What about the you have here, you didn't have time to do this, the abrogation. So that's something that I guess is not really in vogue now, but in the Gemara, it comes up once in a while.
The Gemara talks about the concept of Avkeinu Rabbanan L'Kiddushin Mineh, that sometimes the rabbis have the ability to abrogate the marriage. According to many Rishonim, it's a little bit different from Anomen, because according to many of the authorities, it's only Mikana L'Haba. It means that up until now they were married, but now from here on in, we're going to declare them to be unmarried. And how does this work? This works through some sort of a device where we declare right now that even though it looked like, you know, you ask the witnesses under the chuppah, is this ring worth a pruta? And they always say, yeah, of course it's worth a pruta. What's a pruta? 2.5 cents or something like that. So the rabbis suddenly wake up and say, you know what? It wasn't worth a pruta after all. So therefore, there wasn't a sufficient object of value that was presented under the chuppah. So how do the rabbis have the right to do such a thing with respect to a marriage which is contracted according to Torah law? So the Gemara says everybody who gets married having in mind to get married according to the opinion of the rabbis, and the rabbis declare that the marriage is no good. So there are different questions as to whether this concept can be employed nowadays. There were some authorities who said no, only at the time of the Gemara. But even according to the authorities who say it can be employed nowadays, such as Rabbi Avadya Yosef has that position, that he thinks it can be employed even nowadays. It was, if you look in the Gemara, every single case where it was employed, there was a get. It was a get that was given on condition, but the condition wasn't fulfilled based on something that was beyond the husband's control. He said, I'll come back. If I don't come back within 30 days, it's a get. He tried to come back, and suddenly they closed the bridge, and he wasn't able to cross the bridge. So the Gemara says that in such a case, since there was a get that was given, there was just a side problem with it, so we're going to declare that we're going to declare this get to be valid. Or it has a couple of other cases, a get shchidmeira, person who gives a get on his deathbed with the condition that it only be valid if he actually dies. Or a case where a person appoints an agent and he cancels the agent, but he doesn't cancel the agent in front of enough witnesses, and nobody knows that he canceled the agent. So we say, even though he canceled the agent, the get is still going to be valid. But in all of these cases, if you look in every single case in the Gemara, it's a case where there was a get, there was a side problem with the get. So since there was an essential get, according to Torah law, so the rabbis can say, even though there was a side problem, we're going to do away with that side problem. When there's one case where there was a problem in the actual formation of the marriage, a woman was forced to get married against her will. So we say, since the whole marriage was entered into in an improper fashion, so the rabbis have the right to declare it null and void. But you don't find any cases in the Gemara where a marriage was validly entered into. It was a perfectly normal and valid marriage when it was created. There was no get at all that was given where this concept is employed. So there's a nice long article by one of the rabbinic legal scholars in Israel by the name of Rav Eliyahu Shochetman, where Rav Eliyahu Shochetman goes through in great length showing how in every single case you have either an actual get that was provided or you had a problem in the actual creation of the marriage. But otherwise you can't really utilize this device.
I want to thank Rabbi Reese for coming. Those who want to come and ask some private questions, I think you agree to stay for a couple more moments, but the time schedule can be a little bit sensitive. Thank you very much.